as an artist, I think, Brian, of you and your work in the truest sense of the word, and that your willingness to open to your deepest calling, to be with the whales and to rely on your, you know, to follow your heart and rely on your imagination with, you know, your soul's purpose of sharing this experience that you have, and being in the awesome, really awesome presence of these beautiful creatures. And you know, they've been around for millions of years. I think you mentioned the blue whale's been around for 7 million years. And, you know, imagining, you know, how the whales experience the world. I just love this opportunity to really, you know, be in almost, you know, literally in the eye of the whale. What is it like to experience the world from, you know, from the ocean? And to think, you know, 3,000, you know, thousands of years ago or millions of years ago, the whales could communicate over continents. You know, there was no interference, and just this opportunity to really learn from the whales. So I just wanted to share that Bryant has shown his work, you know, all over the world, in Japan and Norway, in areas where whaling is still practiced. And every time he shows his work, the conversation, you know, he initiates moves beyond the artwork to really explore our sensibilities and our innate knowing or our feeling life. As a youth, Bryant and his mother moved around a lot, so he was always in a new school and having to make new friends. And I remember a poignant in our conversation, he shared that a friend of his at one moment said, you know, do you think you'll ever be with a woman? And in that moment, Bryant realized, you know, I'm not with my tribe. And it was really through experiencing life's difficulties, you know, losing a dear friend, to really realize that he needed to be with the whales. That was his calling. Brian is also a free diver. He can, you know, when he's with the whales, he's just with a mask and a snorkel, you know, and a snorkel. He does not use any scuba diving equipment, and he floats at the top of the water and allows the whales to come to him. So it's that intimate space that he shares, you know, always in absolute reverence of these creatures. And, you know, I think that's what's, you know, I'm excited for Brian to share stories, some of the stories that he has shared with us, and even in this beautiful book that he has recently published, you know, really exploring, you know, what he's learned. But, you know, Brian is such a special person. You know, his nature is so sensitive, highly sensitive. He's incredibly kind and generous and humble, always full of gratitude and so loving and curious. And so I feel just so blessed to be able to have Brian share with all of us today. And this passion to being with the whales, really, this longing came from, you know, childhood, you know, came from a dream. And it's begun a life quest to, you know, share the vast intelligence and sensitivity of these creatures. And really, you know, a creature that is threatened to extinction. And also he speaks about his personal journey as a slow awakening. In 1990, his father took him on a kayak trip to British Columbia, where he experienced a killer whale, you know, coming out of the water, shooting out of the water. And his first time, he was actually eye to eye with a killer whale. And he realized just the vast intelligence and consciousness, and that this whale was actually studying him. And then also experiences of base jumping, too, you know, just his inspiration to want to experience life again, those profound emotions of being in awe and wonder, and that sense of base jumping, really, you know, where you have to be, you're so present in that sport. And that's actually what brought him to photography, was photographing, you know, what it feels like to be in that space. And then I'm not going to share any stories with the whales because I really want Brian to share them, but that fateful day when he was tapped by the pectoral fin of a mother humpback whale, you know, this 2-ton pectoral fin just gently tapping his shoulder, and then being eye to eye and experience that kind and calm, mindful gaze was just, you know, just a life-changing event for Brian. So with that, I'd like to introduce Brian, and just thank you so much for being on the call.
Well, thank you, and it's my pleasure. I look forward to sharing more with everyone.
And I'd also like, Brian, to, you know, something that really stayed with me, too, is when you really opened up to that vulnerable place and were willing to, you know, to listen to your life's calling, to be with the whales, you know, that you heard that inner voice say, you know, you must leave all that is safe and familiar.
Yes, that's... I had a really profound moment with a group of whales. It was the same day the whale touched my shoulder. It was early in the morning. And I'd been seeking the answer to what's been missing, what we can offer, a perspective we can offer of whales that we haven't experienced before. And I just saw five whales and a baby whale in about 60 feet of water with 200-foot visibility. So you can see reefs and boulders. You can see their shadows tracing along the sandy bottom and over the rocks. And it was so beautiful. And I realized I've waited my whole life for this moment. And then I realized you don't see this every day. You don't see moments like these every day. And often they escape our awareness and presence. And I realized that if you want to be present for such an event, you have to radically change your life. You have to, as you said, leave everything that is safe and familiar to be in that world, to take those first steps.
And maybe, Brian, you can share, at first, you know, I know that when you first became interested in photographing marine mammals, you volunteered at the Marine Mammal Center here in Sausalito, actually right in Northern California, and were photographing sea otters, and you know, that kind of opened up this opportunity to learn about, you know, where they live and their life. And can you maybe talk about how you know, photography and how this calling, you know, brought you to where you are?
Well, yeah, the Marine Mammal Center, that happened right after my friend Mark, you know, asked me if I'm going to be alone the rest of my life, you know, because I never had a partner or had any contact. You know, I was a very isolated person. And when I had that break, when I realized I'm not with my tribe, That was the first opportunity, and I volunteered with the Marine Mammal Center just to be with my people. and I still had my camera, so I started just photographing the seals and sea lions that were being cared for and releasing them as well. And it meant a lot to me. I went there Friday nights after work. It was a 2-hour drive one way. So I mean I would. It was worth it to me to just be with my people and to feel some connection for the first time in my life.
And also maybe actually you can even go back further to when you were young and share an early memory of you know, being drawn to the water. I remember you shared a story about going to the pool to practice, you know, holding your breath and what you experienced in that pool.
Yeah, that was a part of the slow unfolding. You know, waking up to realizing my purpose and waking up to it. That same year, this was 1994, when I was volunteering at the Marine Mammal Center, I came across a very small press release in a dive magazine about how you could swim with whales, and it was a childhood dream, and I was euphoric. I couldn't believe that there was a way to do it, because it's against the law in the United States. You can't do it, and it was in another country. And so to practice and prepare for this, I started freediving in a swimming pool, which is really dangerous, especially by yourself. You shouldn't do it. Always have a buddy. But I remember at night I would just lay on the bottom of the swimming pool and just stare up at the stars through the water and just hold my breath. And I remember watching the moon through the water, and you could actually see it almost, they call it a Doppler shift. I don't know if that's what's really happening, but one side of the moon is blue. There's like a blue halo, and the other side there's a red halo. And I was just very calming. Just, I have very fond memories of those times. And that was just before I went to the Azores to swim with whales for the first time with several sperm whale families. And that really began to unfold everything much more quickly after that experience.
And can you share that moment when you decided to really kind of shed all your possessions and just you know go to be with the whales, and and, you know, kind of maybe a little bit of a series of setbacks that you experienced, and you know, the you know, emotional difficulties too. And this is a just a huge, huge shift for you. And then this experience with corduroy, like, you know, in that place of almost like depression, like, how, you know, what happened? You know, what shifted?
Yeah, you know, the morning I described that, witnessing that spectacle of those five whales and the calf with them, and realizing what I've been missing. And also, you know, before me, I was with a group of people. We were on a tour group, and a bunch of them swam ahead and were in pursuit of the whales, and the whales swam away. And I just floated there still, just trying to take them in for the few moments I had. And seeing the people swim towards the whales, these are people that love whales, but realizing when there's a scarcity of time, that we compromise our own behavior and you know, the well-being of something we love, and we disrupt them. And that's when I had that realization that I've been doing this wrong, and it really was heightened later in that day when I was floating again, watching a mother and calf sleeping, and they kind of awoke from their sleep and came up to me, and the calf came in front of me, almost on a collision course, like he was coming in close, and he turned away at the last moment. And I remember my camera lens, it makes things look small. It's a wide angle lens, so when everything through the viewfinder looks incredibly small, but I knew he was close, and I was worried that his tail would touch my camera. And so I lowered it and I just looked up, and I was just taken aback by this side of this belly button going by my face. And I remember just being in awe of all the fine detail in this whale's body, all the true colors and the subtle tone changes. And I could see his skin and musculature flex over his frame as he powered his tail down one more time. And his tail went right by my mask about a foot away. And you know, he's only 5 weeks old, and they have tremendous mind-body awareness in relationship to us in the water. And I just was stunned, and I floated there. My mind was trying to reconcile what I just experienced, and as a way to share with all of us, you know, these profound encounters. And that's when I felt this solid tap on my shoulder, and it was too solid to be human. And I remember feeling a bit of dread as I turned to look over my shoulder. The camera was to my side. And I looked, and there was Mom. She had reached out with a 15-foot-long, 2-ton pectoral fin and touched me with the very tip to let me know she was behind me. She touched my left shoulder blade. And if you hold out your hand right now with your fingers close together, and, like, you know, your arm is like a pectoral fin, if you see your middle finger, that's like the longest finger. She touched me with essentially that part, like the apex of her pec fin. If she had touched me with the leading edge, like where your pinky is, she would have broken my back. And so they have such delicate care, the capacity to be so careful with us. And I'm always humbled by that. And I remember when I looked in her eyes, I was shaking physically. I felt her restraint, you know, and her care. And she was looking into my eyes, and it was a calm, mindful gaze where their eyes are heavy, or the lids are heavy, so they're not wide open, you know, which would be a sign of distress. So it was a very calm, moving expression that she presented me, and I never forgot it. I went back to the boat to collect my thoughts. I went up to the flybridge and realized that I built a prison. You know, like I built this prison my whole life of really following my parents' advice of wanting safety, wanting security, a good paying job, all the things that, you know, in life that are important and to some degree are important for our longevity and sustainability during our time here. But I had literally built a prison. And what that means is I had to go home. I was there for about 12 days, and that was it. I had to go home, back to this life I had. I couldn't, I didn't have the capacity to just say, you know what, I'm going to stay here for another 2 months. This is important. Something is happening. I need to explore this idea, this inspiration that was given to me. I had the inspiration to create life-size portraits of whales to share with as many people as possible, to give us a memory of what they really look like, and to allow whales to influence spark unexplored thought and emotion from people who've had no reason to be moved by whales or their plight. And I realized this prison I created, and I had to go. If I had to go, like, I could not stay. And it just really rocked me and moved me to tears. I was really devastated by it. I felt like I was being ripped out, like a tree, like just ripped right out of the ground when I left the Kingdom of Tonga in the South Pacific. This was 2004. And for the following 16 months, I wasn't ready to leave everything safe and familiar. This is what my inner voice is telling me. And I tried to do both. I tried to live my regular life and then pursue this inspiration. And I was doing both poorly and really went into a deep depression. And I remember it got so bad that I was worried I would possibly take my own life or hurt myself. And I remember I sold my truck already to raise money to go back in the field, and I just walked out of my office. I told my boss I had to leave, and I got on a bus and went to the crisis center at Dominican Hospital here in Santa Cruz, and I checked myself into a locked facility, and I was terrified because I realized this isn't how I'm going to get better. This isn't a place for healing. It's a place where you're medicated and numbed to the pain, to where you can cope with the life you created that's not your life's purpose. It's not in alignment with who you are. And I just kind of went into a deeper depression. And thankfully, my psychiatrist talked to the attending doctor, and she agreed to release me in his care. And I visited him the next day, and he just told me I have to do something because I'm either ultimately will take my own life or die of a heart attack. And those words just stopped me cold. And I had a therapist as well. They were friends, my psychiatrist and my therapist, and their offices were next door to each other. So I walked out of his and into hers. And she knew what had happened, and we just sat there in silence. And I shared a few things with her, and then she said, she just paused for a moment and looked at me and just said, "I don't know how to help you." And I was really stunned and really just kind of felt hopeless. And we sat there together quietly for maybe just 30 seconds. And then I just remembered that day with the wells about that inner voice telling me I have to leave all that's safe and familiar. And I think I remembered it, and then I just honored it. And I thought, you know, I really have to listen to this. And it was like this weight was coming off of my shoulders, and I looked at her and I said, I have to quit my job. I have to leave everything that's safe and familiar, and I need to do this. Mm-hmm. And that decision, that acceptance was honored, you know, that realization was honored, I've never been in places that dark anymore. It's always a challenge to do something new, especially something that's never been done before, and it's all a mystery. But I've always felt better, and it builds momentum. And that was basically it. I left my job 3 months later, sold everything I owned, and I had enough funding for about 124 days of field work, and that was basically to learn. See what it's going to take to create these kind of photographs. And I knew you'd have to be with whales for at least 3 months at a time, because if you're lucky, 1% of the time, you'll find a whale who exhibits exceptional behavior where they'll just come right up to you and spend time with you and really allow you to create exciting compositions that move people. And during that time, I learned also that, you know, to make a life-size photo, you have to wait for them to come to you 5 or 6 feet away. And I thought I could do it from 10 feet away. And it took a high degree of trust to get to that place. I was very scared when they come that close to me. When a humpback whale comes that close to you, their pectoral fin routinely passes just beneath your body. It's important to keep your body flat when you're with them. And as long as you don't move, they know where you are. Even if they can't see you, they remember where you are as their tail goes by, and they do take great care not to hurt you accidentally.
Brian, we're having a little bit difficulty hearing you. Can you just speak up just a little bit more, please?
Oh, sure.
You have a very soft and gentle voice. It's very soothing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You just speak up just a little bit. I'd appreciate it. And I guess
sort
of while I have you, I was wondering if you could just take us back to that first moment, just because it was such. It was a game changer for you, and you know now any of us, and especially speaking for myself, I'm eye to eye with the 45-ton animal in my face. I'm gonna be scared out of my mind. I don't know if I would necessarily have the presence. And so I was wondering if you could just tell us what was happening in your head. Weren't you scared in that moment? And that I know it was just a gentle touch, and you know sometimes a touch can change it. But what was it? Was it an accumulation up to that point in your life that at this very moment transformed everything from you?
Well, you know, the one thing I left out from that encounter the night before those moments, I felt my time. I was already there for a week, And I knew this was the last time I was going to photograph whales. I had been doing it for 5 years on a very intense level, and I produced nothing. I had nothing to show for my efforts. And it came at a considerable cost. It cost my marriage and you know, a lot of my emotional well-being. It was just the financial and emotional risk that you take to photograph whales the way I do. I wait for them to come to me, and often nothing happens, and it gets very expensive, and there's a lot of uncertainty and self-doubt and working with whales in this way. And so I was making the decision to quit, and I felt that my time, I thought, if I'm going to quit, I need to spend a little bit more time here. So I had called my boss and just said I need to stay another week, and I kind of regretted that decision. I thought, what am I doing? I'm spending all this money, and I, you know, it's such an important decision if I'm going to quit. And I remember crying, like the hardest I've ever cried for an hour and a half that night before, just really feeling lots of regret and sadness for all the pain and suffering this work's caused in my life and for myself and for my former partner. And then the next day I had that whale touch my shoulder and make eye contact with me. And it's something that I've been seeking for 10 years, since the first time I've been in the water with whales, and
Brian, can you share a little bit about the, you know, how, you know, it's such a healing space to be in the presence of you know, whether it's a whale or an animal, where you're eye to eye, and there's this sense of communication that's nonverbal, almost a vibration that you're experiencing. Can you speak to that a little bit too, of what you experienced in those moments in that space?
It's hard to describe, and I think I am I am a highly sensitive person. I know that's something that exists in about 20% of people in our population, and so some of my friends would tease me after an encounter like that. I've had them many times where I just don't say anything. I go back to the boat, and I'm looking. My gaze is a thousand. You know, I'm just looking into the horizon, and I'm speechless. I can't talk for a half hour, or even longer. And it's like I'm on a subconscious level. I'm trying to process everything that happened, and everything that was exchanged. You know, and I don't know. You know, when they're that close to me and they're looking at me. Yeah, the word whale loses all meaning. They're not whales, and you really...
Well, and maybe you can share the story about Beethoven and his mother and the experience of actually being embraced by a whale. I think that's such an extraordinary story.
Well, yeah, that's another story where I've been touched, where I, you know, the only times that I've had physical contact with whales is when I've been at an emotional low, where I've been really sad, and... So after I sold everything and left my job, I was in the field for 124 days, and I had just a few weeks left, and I had just a few weeks left before I returned to the States, and I had nothing to show for my efforts, and I felt I needed a life-size portrait if my work's going to continue. And I remember just having another night where I didn't sleep, and I felt a lot of regret and anxiety for the decisions I made, and I just stayed up, and I waited for the sun to come up and put my camera back together and walked out to the dock to meet my skipper, and within 20 minutes I was with this mother and calf. And these were two whales that I had spent several days with, and I knew them as individuals. And I named the calf Beethoven. He would try to wake up his mother and get her to do something, to play with him and interact with him, but she wanted to sleep, and she was sleeping in 60 feet of water, and he would like to swim down to her and rub his back all over her body, trying to coax her to move. And he would wave his pectoral fins in the fashion of a conductor, so we started this tradition of naming them after composers. And I remember I was really tired, and I was floating flat on the surface watching them, and I just kind of felt lost. And I remember Beethoven swimming away, and I lost sight of him, and I saw his mother rise to the surface. And as she came closer to me, I saw her eye widen, and I know that's a sign of concern or distress. And before I could do anything, I felt a pressure against my back and the back of my head, and I strained to look up, and I saw the underside of a whale go over the top of my head to where this whale chin, they have a chin, and it just stopped right over my forehead. And I remember lowering the camera to my side, and then this 4-foot-long pectoral fin came around my body and just rested against my chest, and he just held me against his body while we breathed together at the surface for a few moments. And my assistant was in the water and just gently separated us. I didn't want to panic or startle the whale because he could hurt me accidentally. Still a young whale, he's only about 6 weeks old. And it just gave me pause. I thought, you know, here again, you know, when I'm not feeling, when I'm at my lowest, they step in and do something. I don't know if it's a coincidence. I'm always humbled by the timing. And less than 48 hours later, I composed my first life-size portrait of a whale, and it would be my only one out of those 124 days. And that one portrait has led to the creation of everything I've done since. It was presented to the key people that saw it and wanted my work to continue.
And there's this sense, Brian, in your life where when you're just so vulnerable, and like you said, it's so interesting you say you're in that really sad state, because I have spoken to another dear friend who's a writer who also shares that when she's in a depressed state, the animals come to her, and there's this incredible communication that happens. And I feel like it's a place where we can really learn from these creatures, like the wild. It's so available. It's almost like they're waiting for us to communicate with them. And you have found this, as you know, by investing in time and a relationship with them, where the whales remember you. You know, when you go back, you've shared with me that, you know, the whales come, they remember you. And, you know, it's extraordinary for us to really take in and realize we just know so little. We are just scratching the surface of the kind of communication that's possible, and such a beautiful way back for our connection to the natural world, such a way back for us, especially at this time when our Earth, you know, we don't know how much longer we're all going to be here. You know, we are in this kind of, where there needs to be a great turning and a way back, and that the animal kingdom is this incredible opportunity just waiting for us to come back.
I'm often asked, do I feel that whales remember me? And they certainly have the capacity to remember me as an individual, but what's missing to remember any of us as individuals, and what's missing is we've never been willing to make the time, to invest the time with them. And, you know, when you were willing to commit 3 months with a specific population of whales, and what you can do when you're with them that long, you can communicate with them. And you can communicate intention, and you show up every day with them, and you're visually distinct. You have a very visually distinct, high-contrast wetsuit. You use the same boat, and you behave the same way, very respectful and predictable in your movements. And over time, they become more curious and more accepting. And just on that most basic level of communication, things can begin to happen, things that are just beyond our imagination.
Well, I also feel what is a great gift for you too is that you're so open to collaborating, and that you have friends who are scientists and engineers and all these different professions, and the idea of really sharing, like, you know, collaborating to learn more and to push kind of this inquiry, you know, not only scientific but really, you know, this is such a beautiful a beautiful connection of art and science working magically together.
Oh yes, I mean the tools are emerging for incredible discoveries, whether it's photography, recording whale vocalizations and song, and possibly understanding it on a deeper level, which is something that's been missing since we first began studying living whales 45 years ago.
Can you speak to your one of your mentors? You mentioned the wonderful Roger Payne, whose discovery of a humpback whale song in 1967 really started the environmental movement and the Save the Whales, and kind of what that meant to you.
Oh yeah, Roger Payne, Dr. Roger Payne is just an incredible individual. I don't want to be incorrect, but he's probably the first whale biologist to study living whales. And prior to his work emerging, biologists would study dead whales generally on whaling boats, even here in California. And he did this by being with the southern right whales in Argentina year-round. He would have a research station there, and when they would come up to mate and give birth and off of Peninsula Valdez, his team would be there throughout the season studying them, and he also did this with humpback whales in Bermuda. And he and Scott McVeigh and his wife Katie Payne discovered humpback whale song, and it's been known for centuries, but no one knew what it was. You know, mariners would hear it in the hulls of their ships, and no one really knew what it was. And he recorded it, and they ultimately learned that these are musical compositions with all the same qualities of human compositions. Roger Payne also plays the cello. He's a musician, and he understood this. And so not only did he learn that possibly for 7 million years we've had another species expressing themselves through art, if you will, and the compositions themselves were incredibly moving. Many of the people on the phone with us today probably remember when they first came out, and I'm sure they've heard them since. It radically changed our perception of the natural world and how we look at the oceans and how we look at whales. Whaling ended for the most part all around the world. And really the environmental movement was just launched because of this. And there's been no equivalent event since. And that was, as you said, Anne, about 45 years ago. And there's been nothing since. And I really think the next breakthrough will be just answering a question. And it's a question that we're not even asking yet, is, you know, are we alone in the universe? And we spend hundreds of millions of dollars listening for signs of life in the cosmos, but we're really not doing anything right now to understand what's here, and in particular with whales and dolphins, especially whales in the wild, because dolphins can be studied in captivity, but then so much gets lost in that process. But studying a wild whale, how they communicate, what does 7 million years of evolving knowledge, culture, and language look like in the largest brain ever to exist on Earth, a brain that is seven times the size of our own? What does that look like? Is there something there? And if there is, can we make contact? And it might sound crazy and absurd to many, but the tools are emerging that will allow us to possibly make contact, understanding how they communicate with each other, understanding maybe they have an oral history, you know, that we can learn from, you know, that's millions of years old. There's so much we don't know yet. And I one of the main reasons I create this work is to inspire the next generation of children growing up who may become scientists, adventurers, artists, engineers. These are these are the fields that could lead to some profound discoveries.
I was really inspired by what you just said about this idea of looking at and animals and whales who have been in existence for so long, and this idea of how they have could be a source of history for us, and what's happened and what's being passed down. I mean, we think about oral tradition and passing on of stories, and you know, it's been around for humans for thousands of years, but to go back millions of years, it really strikes me. And you were saying that, you know, there's cutting edge science that could maybe help move in that direction. So I'd love to hear about some of those discoveries of where people are trying to work, you know, because I, you know, as I was saying in the beginning about like how animals have been able, they try to communicate in different ways. I mean, we've taught gorillas how to communicate via sign language, and there's obviously ways to do so outside of them straight up speaking. And so I'm curious what it is, you know, within the world of whales.
Yes, I feel exactly what you feel, you know, the wonder and awe and the mystery. And I, you know, in addition to my work, you know, my art, I have many friends who are engineers and programmers and scientists, and I've just been quietly over the last 2 years just cultivating relationships with them, and I have specific ideas how the data can be gathered and how it can be analyzed, and it takes a long time to bring everything together, and hopefully I'll be able to do that in this decade.
Brian, can you share also a little bit about your work in creating an experience of feeling the whales? You refer to it as intrasonic vocalizations, and where the decibel level is lower than what we can hear, but we can actually feel. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. You know, in addition to photography, I work in video and sound for my exhibitions, and part of the sound includes infrasonic vocalizations from blue and fin whales. They're the two largest creatures ever to exist on Earth, and they're only about 2% left in the world, and they can communicate below, I believe, possibly to 10 hertz. Our threshold is 20 hertz. That's the lowest we can hear. And these calls are so powerful and so low that they can communicate with each other across thousands of miles in the ocean and keep in touch with, you know, other whales for a variety of reasons, for courtship, for feeding if they want to, coordinate with each other to find food, and they've been doing this for over 7 million years. And these calls are something I reproduce in the exhibits. I have a sound system that you can feel the calls in the floor. You can feel them in the walls, and then you'll hear other recordings as well that are more audible. So it completes the experience. But I've always been fascinated by the theory of reproducing sound, especially at around 12 hertz, which is, I believe, the same. It puts you in the alpha state, which where it's a state of mind we're in when we're dreaming. So it can make us more receptive to what we're seeing. And so I experiment with that in my audiovisual installations.
And so people will have experience of feeling a sense of that awe and wonder that you do when you're in the water with the whales.
Yes, it's incredibly unfamiliar. There's really no professional or consumer level sound equipment that can reproduce these sensations. So they're lost to all of us. And it can be done, and it's a gift when we can be in a room and experience it. It's obviously a greater gift to be with one in the water and experience it firsthand. And I love working with aspects about whales that are incredibly unfamiliar to us, because that's sort of where the aha moments can happen. I used to play humpback whale song in my exhibits, but I find that it's too familiar and it's easy to tune out. And so I love working in areas that are completely unfamiliar to us, and And I think those when that can be done, it's the possibility for profound emotion being evoked becomes more possible. It's more exciting.
You know, Anne, I love where these questions are going, and I want you to keep going. I do want to give some of the callers that are online an opportunity to ask questions if there are any or as they arise.
Hi, Brian.
Hi.
Absolutely awesome listening to you. My goodness, what experiences. Wow.
Thank you.
My deeply felt gratitude and namaste to you. And for being the messenger from the water world. So, as much as we all love water, the ocean in all its forms, there's also the fear. I mean, can you please tell us, or give us some advice about how we could conquer the fear that we have about the sea or the ocean or the forms of water? And how you did it yourself?
Oh, I'd be happy to. The first thing to remember is that we are aquatic mammals. We are aquatic. We are highly adapted to the ocean world.
Okay.
I think we've evolved from earlier primates that were aquatic, earlier upright hominids that were aquatic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's evident in freediving. We have tremendous capacity to do amazing things in holding our breath and diving really deep. And that capacity is within all of us.
Okay.
I learned to hold my breath for 4 minutes in 2 days with an instructor, and he helped me tap into everything that my body has ready to offer to me, and I didn't know how to do it. In terms of overcoming fear, the thing to remember is that even though we're so well adapted to the ocean, imagine setting foot in the ocean and swimming for the first time with a snorkel and mask and feeling afraid. It's almost like it's like you're being born to the ocean environment. Like this is your first experience as a newborn into this world, and it's going to be it can be scary and overwhelming at first. You know, I would encourage you to make an introduction to the ocean world in a place that's warm, with really clear, beautiful visibility and a beautiful environment to take in. And it takes your mind off of the ocean, you know, the fears. And, you know, when you could see fish and see beautiful reefs and just to make it very gentle.
Yeah. I had been snorkeling, actually. I mean, I did feel that, you know, absolute calmness and that blue. Okay, and then? Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, and eventually you can overcome your fears. And I would actually encourage you to think about breath hold diving.
Okay.
I can recommend a class that I take. I still take their program. It's never-ending what they can teach. And the beauty of free diving, breath hold diving, and returning to, you know, our roots, if you will, is it's incredibly calming. When you're done, after you're done free diving, when you're holding your breath and diving to the bottom, it could just be 10 feet. You know, when you start out very gentle, you feel so relaxed and so euphoric. It can last for a couple of days. It's just such a calming, rejuvenating experience. I can't describe it. It is incredibly demanding on our bodies as well. We'll burn more calories holding our breath and diving than any other form, any other sport or any other fitness activity. But you don't feel like you're doing anything demanding. It's very subtle.
Okay.
And that could help overcome the fear as well. It's another form of meditation. You learn to lower your heart rate. You learn to saturate your blood with oxygen and to help you feel relaxed and you just learn to quiet your mind, and it's all part of it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you. I wish I could dive with you. Too far-fetched, maybe. Thank you.
Yeah, wow. Like Gayatri said, Anne and Brian, thank you so much. This has been a fascinating dialogue, and thank you for gifting such a beautiful insight. I love water. I love swimming, and I can't wait to explore this breath-hold diving adventures. And it reminded me of this experience of, you know, this idea of cessation of the breath takes you to the point that there is like zero. There is nothing, not even the breath, is state of shunya or the zeroness someone was sharing. Yeah, thank you for bringing up that memory. And my next question comes from a whale. I was going to ask you, have you ever asked a question to a whale and what came out of it? Vice versa, has a whale really looked into your eye and asked you something and what came out of that? Thank you.
Well, no, thank you. You know, that's an interesting question. I do ask questions, and I even will write them down on paper, and then I try not to think about them and just see if the answer will just come through my subconscious or through an encounter. I feel that they have answered my questions, but it's never happened instantly, and it's been such a slow unfolding. And the realizations come very slow and incrementally with them. The more time I spend with them, I think the more quickly things unfold. It's very subtle.
Yeah, that's what I thought, yeah.
I mean, I have fear. You know, like when I had fear of being so close to whales, I had a whale. One whale in particular really helped me overcome that fear. He just came incredibly close. He rubbed his head against my body. He was a sperm whale. And then he came forward to meet my eye, so he was eye-to-eye with me, maybe 4 feet away. And he rolled on his side, and his five-foot-long lower jaw with rows of teeth in it was open just beneath my body, just beneath my feet. I had to make sure that my foot wouldn't go inside his mouth.
Oh, my.
And he just looked at me. He was very friendly, very curious and playful, and he just helped me overcome that fear. I mean, that's, you know, those are the kind of questions I have, is can I do this safely? Is it sustainable? And I still worry about that, but then I'll have an encounter like that where he's just showing me that I can trust him, you know, that I'm safe.
Wow.
Hi, Brian. Sorry, this is Kanchan. This is amazing to hear all these stories, and I'm getting goosebumps. It's true, like we were sharing in the beginning, you have these misconceptions, and I had so many about whales because they're huge, and it's natural to feel scared, but from your stories, I see that, well, maybe I'm wrong. So I'm just wondering, what are some of the lessons that you have learned from these wonderful creatures?
Yeah, they're just on a personal level. I mean, they're symbolic to me on the power of just tapping into one's purpose and embracing it and not being afraid. It took a lifetime to get there, and they once I had contact with them, the process quickly sped up. and you know, certainly with them, I mean, I'm just thinking out loud. I guess the only thing they teach me, they remind me that, you know, as Anne said in the beginning, is that the world is so much bigger than our imagination. And they make that evident to me every time I'm with them.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
You know, Brian, just to kind of follow up there on Kanchan's question, you know, this, you know, learning to overcome some of that fear. I mean, how have your interactions with the whales played out in your interactions, you know, with at home or with friends or with family or, you know, with people that you come across?
Yeah, it was an interesting experience. You know, when you worry about alienating yourself when you know, make a leap like this where you leave your job and sell everything you own, and then I stayed with my mom for several years at her guest room, and I was very grateful for that. But you worry that you're an outcast, that you're not accepted anymore. And every time I sold something, or the day when I left my job, I just checked in with myself. I said, you know, does this feel okay? And I would always say, yeah, this is okay. I'm still here. This is still me. And I'm okay. And there's that fear. I'm thinking of other fears. There's the fear, obviously, of being close to a well, and I shared some insights on how I've overcome that to some degree. I also had a great fear of what would happen when I exhibit my work in countries that commercially hunt whales, and even in cities that have active whaling fleets, and I was terrified. It was a completely disarming and heartwarming experience. I went to these countries not as an activist, not to protest or to judge or point fingers, to merely share and give viewers complete freedom to explore their own emotions and really have faith in humanity that we each of us has a capacity to make a change, to make a profound shift, if we're given the trust and freedom to explore our own emotions on a given subject. And it really revealed to me that with sufficient time and care, these changes are possible. I guess the other fear that, you know, I would be alone, you know, during this whole process, you know, that no one would want to be with me, you know, because I have nothing material to offer. And I realized after a couple of years that it's nothing personal, it's just a difference in values. And what I was doing was accidentally, I was just creating space for that one person who shared my values, and I'm very grateful to Cheryl, her and I've been together for over 2 years now, and she let me into her life when I've had nothing other than my photographs, and we've been able to build a really nice life together, connecting with someone who shares my values, and it's been incredibly profound.
That's beautiful. That's very, very beautiful, Brian. I appreciate you sharing that. I kind of wanted to draw on that as well about, you know, your exhibits, you know, and your intentions for the exhibit. I mean, if I come and see one of your exhibits, what is it that, you know, you want me to walk away with? You know, what is it that you really want your viewers to feel or experience or take away, you know, whether it's, you know, a visual exhibit, one of the large projects that you have going on now or are in the works or that you've already displayed, what is it that you want them to walk away with?
I think the most important thing, the first thing that I want, is I want to provide you with a profound memory of what they look like. I want you to have something you could contemplate after you've left the exhibit and returned to your life, and to always have that sense, that memory, that impression. And then perhaps when you read about whales in the newspaper or on television, if a whale's entangled in commercial fishing gear or something other, you know, something else that may be happening, that you'll have that reference, that point, you know, that will make them a little bit more important or relevant in our world. It's very difficult. When I was in Norway and Japan, they knew why I was there. It was very, I didn't have to say anything. But here in my home country, I'm sharing photographs of whales that are beautiful and they look healthy and happy, but they face challenges that are far more serious than whaling. And that's entanglement in commercial fishing gear. And I don't know how to communicate that in a way we can receive it. In a way that's where we are receptive, where we're not going to just tune it out completely because it's so upsetting. But I would love to inspire all of us to lose our appetite for fish and all that comes from the ocean that's commercially caught and that inevitably kills many whales and dolphins every year. And I'm still trying to learn what I can do, what I can create to convey that.
Brian, I also wanted to share with everyone on the call today that, you know, there are very few people in the world that are trained to disentangle whales from ghost nets and fishing nets, and you are one of them, which is extraordinary.
Once everything is funded and the permits are approved for my involvement, I've you know, my goal is to work with a whale entangled in commercial fishing gear. I won't be in the water. It's too dangerous. But I would photograph them remotely with a camera deployed over the side of a very small, little inflatable. And the goal is to create life-size, one-to-one scale photography of whales, living whales entangled in fishing gear, and to share it on their scale, and to not really attach too much messaging with it, just to create space for questions and to and spark and explore thought and emotion to ultimately create dialogues about what's happening. Did this whale survive? What are those lines from? And you know, and it's for, you know, and I, we could have a dialogue about with journalists and with the public that you know this is our love of Dungeness crab or lobster, our love of you know prawns and fish caught in gill nets, and we could have a whole new dialogue and make it really evident of what's at stake. And the photograph itself would be entitled One of 3 Million, which is a conservative estimate on how many whales, dolphins, and porpoises drown in fishing gear every decade. And I hope, too, that the title could be sufficient enough to spark more dialogue and more compassion.
Hello, we have another question here in the queue.
Thank you, Amit. Brian, that's such a noble service that you offer. In saving the entangled whale. So you have my special bow of gratitude for that. It's such a deeply touching, and I also deeply resonated with what you expressed in terms of inspiring everyone to, you know, disciplining our appetite. That is so apt. A quick question following along with one of Amit's question was, if there were any moments in your encounters with whales, if they had any, if you think or if you decoded, if there were any special messages that they were trying to convey to other species and especially for humans.
Yeah, you know, I when I'm with them, I think, you know, they're so perfect and beautiful in so many ways, and just gentle and mindful, and it's such a contrast to the challenges we face as human beings, and it makes evident the work, all the work that still has to be done for us that we have to do within ourselves, you know, and I think that's the one thing they do make evident is that in some ways we have to save ourselves.
That's beautiful. One other thing that I always think of when I see the dolphins and the whales in the water is that the harmony and the symbiotic relationship, in that gentleness and the softness and everything, like so in like a symphony with the water. So beautiful. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
That actually brings up a question for me as well, around this idea of, you know, you photograph whales, and I'm curious about when they're baby whales are around the mother, you know, whether they're nursing or just around it, you know, they would tend to be more protective. And so, how you've been able to photograph the baby whales as well?
I'm glad you asked. I normally tend to not focus too much on mother and calf pairs because I know mothers can be shy, and often they'll just escort the calf away from me if I attempt to observe them. There are some mothers who are completely accepting, and they may be more experienced mothers. They've done this for many years, raising their young around boats and people in the water, and they're more relaxed. So with them, I'll spend more time with them. And it's important to be very careful with the young ones because they are playful, and there's always is a chance that they could hurt us accidentally, and by just being too playful and loving. and also, the calves, one in particular, used me as a tool to get his mother's attention because she's sleeping and she wants to rest, and so he would deliberately come up to the surface and swim behind me and float right next to my feet. Like, so he's putting me in between he and his mother, which moms will always surface and escort him away if they do that. And so if I ever I see a pattern of them being mischievous, I always return to the boat and just and we'll just continue searching for other whales. And having said that, I've also had a young whale, probably a 6 or 7 week old calf, come to my rescue. The last time I was in the field, I was observing he and his mother resting. I was waiting for them to come to the surface and possibly come right next to me for photography. And I had 4 sharks circling underneath me, coming up to inspect me. And I also had 3 5-foot-long barracuda right behind me, right behind my fins. And I knew this moment was going to happen any minute because they had been resting for some time. And I there was really nothing I could do. If I tried to flee, it would encourage more curiosity from barracuda and from the sharks. And so I just floated there still and just tried to not respond to them. And this calf came right up to me, and he flashed his belly, which was completely white, at the sharks and the barracuda, and they all just scattered, and then he came right up to me.
So moving. You know, I'm also, you know, one of the things that Prakash's question also brought up for me was this idea, you know, what questions would the whales ask you, and this idea of communicating with them, and then you also taking your exhibits to countries that, you know, that do the whaling, or I guess, you know, and the reason I bring that up, it brings to this idea of sort of nonviolence. I almost feel that oftentimes, you know, human beings and a species in themselves, that often we think that we, you know, because we've invented certain technologies or have created this ability to try to dominate the species, even though in sort of just, let's call it hand-to-hand, we would handily lose, we feel like there's a sort of a superiority complex that sort of comes with it. And I'm curious on, you know, in your interactions and even sort of your subtle activism with these folks in terms of communicating the intelligence of these creatures and their just how they've sustained over the years, and kind of if you've been able to sort of maybe create an aha moment for some of these individuals.
Oh, yes, it's definitely the intention, and there's nothing more exciting than witnessing it. And with journalists in both Japan and Norway, we had a completely new dialogue about whales. It's normally, whenever there's someone who's not in favor of whaling, it could lead to a very polarized discussion with a journalist. And we never entered into that. Even when journalists brought whalers into the press conference to meet me, maybe they were looking for drama. the journalists, they had a shift themselves, and we didn't even talk about whaling. They just wanted to know, how could I be so close to a whale, and how come they're not hurting me? And I could talk about these whales as individuals. These are whales that I've seen for several days or sometimes several weeks. And I remember even seeing 2 whalers that were just silent. I'm not sure what evoked silence in them, and I spoke with them. And really, these are our most difficult, most challenging audiences, and I wanted to see if I could reach them and give them pause, create something that would give them pause, and I felt that if it was possible, then I might be able to create work that could address the far more serious issues that whales and dolphins face and share with all of us all over the world.
And if I could just join in for a moment and just share that it's really your intention that is so pure, and that so when you are in this situation that, you know, the reaction is really more about you invite this the feeling life, you know, you connect to people from the place of feeling, and so it's a heart connection, which is so powerful. And Amit, you bringing up nonviolence, it's, you know, it reminds me of Gandhi. You know, he didn't, you know, it wasn't about any judgment. It's just allowing people to come. You know, you're sharing something sublimely beautiful and intimate and loving, and it comes from such a purity that it can't help but just open us, crack us open. It's beautiful, and I'm so grateful. Thank you, Brian, so much.
Thank you. Yeah, it's so important. And I've had good teachers. You know, I was a full-time volunteer with Sea Shepherd, and many may know their approach to these issues, which is very confrontational. And I learned that it wasn't for me, and it was just an important part of the process to learn how we could affect changes in ways that might be more long-lasting and meaningful.
And I want to share with everyone before we close that, you know, you're working on a film, which if you want to share a few words about that, but also you're also working on a major exhibition next year in Australia, which is exciting, and you have a beautiful book out now with actually in a lovely website called theocosmos.com. So there's opportunities for us to continue to learn from you and share, you know, with others the good work that you do.
Thank you
so much.
Did you want me to share more on the film, Anne, or?
Well, if you want to just say a few words about the film for us to keep our, you know, to keep aware or keep our mind open, or any way that we can support you and your work too, Bryant, please. You know, it would just be an honor.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, my book, Beautiful Whale, was just released in April. That is probably one of the better ways to support my work right now. And we are working on a 3D IMAX film that has been presented to National Geographic, and we're waiting to see if it's greenlit. It'll be featuring my work with sperm whales in the Eastern Caribbean with my friend who also studies the same sperm whale families I work with. He has spent over 10 years with these families and has studied them as intimately as one would study a family of mountain gorillas. And it's really humbling to be with a person who has such a deep and intimate awareness of a specific family of whales.
Well, Brian, thank you so much. And thank you for being an incredible moderator for the call. And Brian, thank you for sharing your insights and really going deeper within to share about moments of your life, even some of the challenges that you've had and some of these intimate experiences.